Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And welcome to TMR number 295 for the 13th. I don't know if there's any significance to that number, I hope not. The 13th of our movie roundtable sessions, in which we discuss films or other types of production that have relevance to themes explored on The Mind Renewed over the last 10 years or so. So today we're going to be chatting about the superb German language war film, historical war drama from 2004. So really getting up to date now, about the final days of Adolf Hitler in his Berlin bunker and the defeat of his Nazi regime called Downfall, or in German, I'm looking forward to this moment, Der Untergang. That was my moment now, Der Untergang. And if you haven't seen that, I expect most of you have, let me say that it is, in my view anyway, an absolutely fantastic film, probably one of my favourites now, and one which I've been waiting to discuss on the roundtable for quite a long time. So again, if you haven't seen it though, just a word of warning, it is pretty disturbing in places, which of course it has to be to depict what happened in a faithful way. So a brilliant film matched by brilliant roundtable participants to discuss Der Untergang. Got to get it in again. We are joined once again by Frank Johnson in California, Mark Campbell in Crayford, and Anthony Rotuno in a safe house somewhere in the UK. Gentlemen, welcome back to the roundtable.
Hello.
Hello, thank you.
Hi, thanks.
It's great to have you all on again. Thanks very much for joining us again. It's brilliant. Now, I normally ask all of you how you're doing, but I thought maybe I'd give that a miss this time because, you know, if your lives are anything like mine, then there isn't necessarily that much to report each time. I don't know. Maybe there is, but I thought I'd put it differently today. Has anybody got anything interesting at all to share with us?
Well, I could plug a podcast, maybe.
Go on, then.
Well, one of my three podcasts, Film Gold, we've just done a two-parter on Michael Caine. Oh, yeah. And the guy I did it with and I are both big Michael Caine fans, so that was a labour of love. Mm-hmm. I was going to do an impression of Michael Caine saying, Der Untergang, but I don't think I will.
Go on, have a go.
I got cold feet, so, yeah.
I recently got a DVD copy of Get Carter, actually.
Oh, yes.
Which I was really pleased by because it's often on the TV, but it's on those channels where they cut it up into, you know, two parts full of adverts. And mm-hmm. I found a good copy of it, so it'd be nice to watch it through one day. It's a good film.
Mm. Yeah, we counted down our top 10 Caine performances, and that was my friend had that number one, and I had it number two.
Which is the top then, Italian Job or Zulu?
No, Sleuth.
Sleuth, yes.
The one with Laurence Olivier, yeah.
What about The Magus? Sorry, off track here, because I haven't seen it.
Oh, no, I haven't seen it.
Based on a John Fowles novel that I didn't even know existed until recently. And John Fowles, the author of the books, disowned it. But that's Michael Caine. I'd love to see it. Yeah, 1969 or something.
All right. Mm. That's before he could act, isn't it? 1969.
No, but it's one of those situations where you spend a few weeks with a person. Like, I think I watched 8 or 9 of his films.
Wow.
Not quite every night, but, you know.
I came around to him with Educating Rita.
Yeah, that was in my top five. And the other one was The Man Who Would Be King. Have you seen that?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah. That's Sean Connery as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, of course, Michael Caine is not in this movie we're talking about today, is he?
No.
Thankfully.
Quite relevant.
No, not exactly.
Just because those are the recent podcasts I've
yeah,
done.
Yeah, sure.
Just a little plug.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's get straight on with this film then, Downfall, Der Untergang. I saw it about 9 years ago, I suppose, which was about 10 years after it was released, so, you know, I was late coming to it. But when I saw it, I was stunned by it, and I thought, you know, it was a really incredible, brave telling of events, you know, by Germans themselves, and I think that's the thing that struck me particularly. But then also the fact that Hitler was portrayed as a real person, not that stereotype, just that stereotype, you know, the carpet-biting monster. I don't know if they ever bit the carpet at all, but, you know, my dad told me, oh, yes, he used to bite the carpet. I don't know. There was that side to him, wasn't there, in the movie, of course, but he was also a real person. And no doubt we'll discuss that a lot when we talk about, you know, the intentions of this movie. So what about any of you? Frank, this was new to you, wasn't it?
Completely new. The only part of this movie I'd ever seen was the meme where Hitler reacts to, like, his pizza being laid or whatever. I had never seen the movie outside of that one scene.
Yeah.
So it was completely new to me.
Anthony, was it new to you as well?
I think I'd seen it twice.
Okay.
But since I've been doing film podcasts, it's great, isn't it? When you really analyse something closely in preparation for a podcast, and some films just get better and better, you know?
Yeah.
So I found this was just a totally different experience because I was totally concentrating. Just ended up with too many notes, really. So.
Absolutely, yeah. So the weird thing I found with this, watching it again for the podcast, I found it even more difficult to watch, actually, because when you're taking notes, you have to concentrate more. And it got me down, and I thought, I'm going to have to watch this in two parts because it's just... so dark. But you, Anthony, mentioned also about some of these memes as well, didn't you? Was there one about Amazon Prime delivery?
Yeah, or Amazon price hike or something. I was just making the point that sometimes the funniest ones are the most mundane ones. So Hitler reacts to Aston Villa going out of the European Cup, you know, something like that. The further it is from what he was actually talking about, the funnier.
Yeah.
But there, I mean, there were literally hundreds, I think. Mm. There's not that many now, but...
Yeah, and the funny thing about that is that you might think, oh, well, it's not really the right thing to do with that. But the director himself, I read, approves of that because he feels like it's a continuation of the reason for doing the film, you know? Mm. It fits. It's an extension of the idea of the film, not to give Der Führer any respect that he doesn't deserve, you know? So I think that's... Yeah. So it's interesting to know that he approves of that. Mark, you surely have seen it, haven't you, before?
I have, probably about 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And when I came to watch it again last week, and I sort of was just having a quick look on Wikipedia or somewhere, and it just said it cost $15 million to make. And I thought, my memory of it was that it just took place in the bunker. So I was thinking, $15 million, that's crazy. And then I watched it again, and oh, because of course there's lots of stuff outside the bunker and not a cliche war film, but you know, there's warfare, there's tanks, there's explosions and stuff.
Absolutely.
But my memory of it, interestingly, and I think the best bit of the film is just the bunker. I mean, you could have just set it in the bunker would have been enough to have still imprinted it on one's memory.
Mm. And funnily enough, like the last production that we talked about, A Very British Coup, most of it's talking, actually.
Mm. Yeah.
Not as extreme as that, but yes, a lot of it is.
And
okay, so, go on. Yeah, Anthony.
No, they didn't. We were saying earlier, they didn't do anything like crassly commercial. They didn't add any drama, really, did they? Or dramatic music, not to my knowledge.
They let the events speak for themselves, didn't they?
Yeah, because really? Obviously they were compelling enough or crazy enough, really. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it was all based on, you know, documentary evidence from various sources. Two books in particular, which we'll talk about in a bit. But yeah, the producer was saying how, you know, the things did happen or extremely close to the things that did happen, but they had to sort of compress things, you know, in order to make it watchable. But it was based on truth, and that was dramatic enough. Okay, so what I'm going to do for those few people who have not seen it, I'm just going to go through a quick plot summary here. Okay. After a short present-day interview, that is 2004, with a now elderly woman called Traudl Junger, who is central to the film, the action begins by flashing back to 1942 in East Prussia at Hitler's Eastern Front headquarters called the Wolf's Lair. It's November, and several young women make their way through the trees to be interviewed by Der Führer for the role of personal secretary. The 22-year-old Traudl Junger, although she was Traudl Humps at the time because she got married the following year and became Traudl Junger, she is delighted, a little bit scared, but generally excited to get the job. She made mistakes in her typing while Hitler was interviewing her, but he'd overlooked that. He'd been kind to her and given her the job. Fast forward then to April the 20th, 1945, Hitler's 56th birthday. The action transfers to Berlin now under severe attack by the Russian Red Army. Hitler and those closest to him are now headquarters in the Führer Bunker, an extensive air raid shelter positioned next to the Reich Chancellery. As Operation Clausewitz is initiated, a last-ditch operation to defend Berlin down to the last man, and indeed, in practice it seems down to the last child, some of the Nazi top brass tried to persuade Hitler to leave Berlin, but he refuses and vows either to win or die in the city. Indeed, we see some of the children, Hitler Youth types, in proud uniforms, ready to sacrifice their lives in futile defence against the approaching Red Army. There follows a series of sick ironies, as a young boy Peter is given a medal by Hitler for his bravery, as Hitler's generals tell him that they no longer have the resources to carry out his orders, and he flies into irrational rages, ignoring their every advice, and as Eva Braun, Hitler's partner, throws parties in the Chancellery building. More and more, Hitler behaves irrationally, kind of accepting the inevitability of defeat, yet desperately continuing to fantasize about ways to secure victory. He blames it all on the betrayal and weakness of his generals, and indeed on the failure of the German people themselves to live up to his great ideals. He has deserters executed, falsely accuses people of cowardice, and even orders the arrest of Hermann Göring, his successor, for requesting permission to take over, and the execution of Heinrich Himmler for trying to negotiate with the Allies. Eventually, still vainly hoping in his 12th Army to rescue the day, Hitler dictates his last will and testament to his secretary, Traudl Junger. He has, quote, decided now before termination of life on this earth to marry the woman who, after many years of true friendship, entered voluntarily into this already almost besieged city to share his fate. And after marrying, they shall quickly, quote, choose death to escape the disgrace of being forced to resign or surrender. After which they, quote, wish to be cremated immediately. Thus they marry in the bunker. The next day, the 30th of April 1945, the 12th Army nowhere to be seen, Hitler plans for his and Eva's death with the help of a visiting physician. Blondie, the Führer's beloved dog, is poisoned. He and Eva say a last goodbye to the staff, and the two commit suicide together, after which they are cremated as ordered. Josef Goebbels, who now takes over as leader, Hermann Göring having been disgraced, continues the mad vow never to surrender, and the film reaches an extreme of madness and evil as Magda Goebbels, Josef's wife, poisons their six children with cyanide, so that they won't have to live in a world without the Führer and National Socialism. They then commit suicide together. Shortly, unconditional surrender follows, and we see the young boy Peter and Traudl Junger making their way surreptitiously through the Soviet lines and escaping into the countryside. And the film ends with a return to the elderly Junger, who speaks of her naivety in those days, but also of her and others' guilt, because although there was much evil that they didn't know, there really was no excuse. If they'd wanted to, they could have found out. I think it was pretty closely based on this book by Traudl Junger here. So this was the secretary. She got the job. And the book itself is called Until the Final Hour, which was so closely produced just before the movie. I think it was part of the project, really. Right. And the person who actually wrote the book was a lady called Melissa Muller, and she persuaded Traudl Junger to use her recollections because she didn't want to publish them for a long time, but eventually she agreed to publish them in this book. And although I haven't read every single word, what I have read is really close to what's in the movie. So that was one book, and then there was another book that it's based on, and other writings as well, Albert Speer's writings and other writings. But there was also this other one by a guy who was a German historian who was a consultant for the film, a guy called Joachim Fest. So he wrote a book called Inside Hitler's Bunker, The Last Days of the Third Reich. So those two books were the main things. I haven't read that one, so I don't know how close that is, but obviously he's a consultant for the film, so it must be pretty close.
Did she offer much opinion of Hitler, like personal opinion, or is it more factual?
Oh, yes, lots of opinion.
Oh, there was, yeah.
There's lots, yeah. I have to say, there's quite a lot of tedious detail about what he ate and who came for which party and all that. In some ways, that's good because you get the impression that she was really just writing down the things that she recalled. Mm. One thing I really get from that, and perhaps see if you agree that it was reflected in the film, was the fact that his life and the life of quite a lot of the top brass as well, was just so divorced from the real world. I mean, he would go from the Wolf's Lair, then up the Berghof, they go to the bunker and all this. And he would be having his meal times and he'd have guests to have tea with, and he'd have these polite conversations, and then he'd be talking to his generals and, but how much he actually saw of the real world. I don't know. I get the impression from this, it was all kind of going on inside his head. And so when you get to the end where the generals are saying, look, we haven't got any armies to fight this, inside his head was still, no, we're strong, and I deny everything you say. I just wonder how long that had gone on, perhaps gone on for years. I don't know.
I had one observation. I was surprised how early on in the film the others were basically, I think they were preparing for Hitler's death eventually, and they were preparing for defeat pretty quickly, and they were talking really about how he's not in touch with reality. It was about halfway through the film, maybe. Yes. And I was trying to think, how many of the people in the film do you think are fully indoctrinated? It seemed like it was Hitler, Goebbels, and his wife. Eva Braun had some very strange... I don't know if that was what she was like, but it was very strange, wasn't it?
I think so.
She wanted to have that party and do lots of dancing.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's weird.
Indeed, I think so. From the description in there, that was really close. It was all really close. Anyway, we'll get to talking about the characters in a moment. So All right, so it was released Germany 2004, then in English-speaking countries in 2005, directed by Oliver Hirschenbiegel. It was a name I didn't know, but I found out that I'd actually seen another of his films called 13 Minutes, which is really good. A dramatization of real events, again, a failed attempt to assassinate Hitler. So there you go. So I get the impression he's a very highly respected director in Germany and internationally, and he's got lots of awards, nominations, and directed films with people like Nicole Kidman, Daniel Craig, Liam Neeson, you know, so he's well in there. And from interview, I thought he's really thoughtful and intelligent director, actually. Had any of you come across him before?
No, I have a woefully bad knowledge of German cinema.
Yeah, exactly.
Bruno Ganz, I feel like I know, but I didn't know anybody else in it, to be honest.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I felt like he was familiar as well.
Did Bruno play Hitler in that director's other movie when they tried to assassinate him?
No, I don't think so. That's a while ago that I saw that. No, I don't think it's so. I don't think I'd remember that, yeah.
Okay,
well, let's go on to talk about them then. So he's actually Swiss, apparently. He was Swiss. He has died. I don't know what you thought, but I thought that was the best portrayal of Hitler that I've ever seen, frankly. Any thoughts?
I thought he did really well. He really, for me, brought a human side to Hitler that we've never seen in any movie, you know. He really sold the like mundaneness of Hitler. The only other one I had seen, I probably had seen a couple, but the one that's most memorable to me is the one from Indiana Jones, as silly as that is, where he meets Hitler and he signs the Grail Diary.
Yes.
Oh, do you guys know who it was?
Yeah, I've interviewed him.
Is that Mr. Brunson?
Oh, really?
Yes. I had a very long chat with him. Yeah, interviewed him. Lovely guy.
Michael Sheard, that's it. Yeah. Mr. Brunson in Grange Hill.
Yeah. He's been called to play Hitler several times, I think.
I thought we did so well, Julian, was that it was a tiny bit cartoony, but we were saying that you could believe that that cartoony bit was probably Hitler's real personality. You know?
Yes, I know what you mean.
It was just slightly the way he kind of almost screwed up his glasses in the famous scene.
He was a self-parody, wasn't he?
Yeah.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Absolutely.
The weird thing about Hitler, one of the weird things about Hitler, is that you kind of think you know what he looks like, but when you see footage of him, you kind of think, oh, okay, is that really Hitler? There's something, take away the moustache, and it's a bland face. I think when I say used to people acting Hitler, that there's a kind of weird amalgamation of actors playing Hitler.
Right.
Because so many have done it. And then you actually see footage and you look at it and watch it and think, oh, okay, that's not quite how I imagined Hitler to be. Does that sound strange?
Yeah.
More used to seeing a fictional interpretation of him, I suppose.
And I guess Chaplin captured something, didn't he?
Yeah. You know,
the Great Dictator. Yeah. Obviously heightened for comic effect, but yeah.
But like you're saying about Hitler and Downfall, it seems comedic sometimes, but that's probably quite accurate.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying,
As well as this, dare we say it, sort of cozy uncle figure.
Yes.
I wrote charisma in inverted commas.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
There we go.
I think that's actually one of the things that's so important about the film, and which was one of the intentions of the film, was to humanize Hitler.
Yeah.
Just because so often it's just conceived as being this monster, almost like a supernatural monster. And that's a bit dangerous because if you consider him not to be a human being in some way, then there are some very serious lessons about human nature that won't be learnt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was a human being. And I think they brought that out really well. And also helps, for me, it helps to explain how he could actually capture people's loyalty so much. Even on a personal level. I mean, that scene where you've got the secretaries who are the hopefuls of who's going to work for Hitler, you know, and ends up, of course, being Traudl Junger, who does the job. You know, he walks down the line shaking their hands, being ever so polite with them and avuncular. And
it's like Prince Charles, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. It is. And when I first saw that, I did feel a little uncomfortable about that in the sense that, oh, hold on, this is a mass murderer. How can you portray him like that? But very quickly, I thought, oh, yeah, of course. Of course, he got people's trust that way. I thought that, you know, he didn't really look like Hitler, did he? And come back to what does Hitler look like? But he had such a sort of lived in face, didn't he, Bruno Ganz? And once you stuck the moustache on and got the hair right and the mannerisms and the voice, which apparently spent a lot of time on that voice listening to recordings and stuff, then I think his characterization took over so well that as I was watching it, I just believed it was Hitler.
I think Hitler's health in reality was really bad at that time. I mean, he looked, Bruno Ganz's Hitler was quite weak, looked physically weak, but they could have even done more with that, maybe, because Hitler was in very bad health. physically and obviously mentally.
Yeah. It was a trembling hand thing. Did you pick up on the trembling hand?
His hand behind his back, yeah, the trembling of the hand. When I first saw it, I thought, is he sort of trying to shush people away? But then that's just kind of a shake of his hand, isn't it, behind his back. It's quite telling.
Which could have been Parkinson's, or Trowell Younger suggests it could have been a nervous thing. But there was something like that going on with him.
They didn't mention anything about the amphetamines, because I don't know if it's for a fact, but isn't it fairly well thought that he was probably getting injections of amphetamines or something? Maybe that's why he looked so manic during the speeches. I don't know. Have you heard anything about that?
I had heard that he had been on amphetamines, and I was wondering if there was any proof to that, because I seen one video of the actual Hitler. He's like rocking back and forth, you know, like somebody who got meth or something. It's like,
yeah,
I've seen videos online of people who have smoked crystal meth, and then like they're kind of, you know, they call it tweaking, and they're like doing all kinds of weird movements and stuff. Yeah. And that's exactly what it reminded me of in that video. So I was wondering if there really was any truth to him being on amphetamines.
Well, it's really difficult to tell. I mean, I can only go on the things that I've come across, but somebody said, it might be Trowell actually, you know, he was really concerned about his health. I mean, he wouldn't drink, apparently wouldn't eat meat. There's some debate about that. But anyway, he was very careful about what he ate. And then somebody else said, look, he didn't need drugs because he was high on himself.
Yeah.
Because you can't know. She wouldn't know either, would she?
No. But, I think those would be pharmaceutical rather than recreational, I suppose.
All right.
Yeah. Pharmaceutical. They make a point of, isn't there a scene where he's going to take poison and he's going to shoot himself so he doesn't have a moment's discomfort?
He was advised, wasn't he, also, because the theory that if he shot himself, he might just get an optic nerve instead of succeeding. So if he took the cyanide first, then if the other method failed, then the cyanide would be sure to get him.
Yeah.
That's the idea.
Why not just do the cyanide?
Yeah. I don't know.
I thought they were trying to make a point that he didn't want to suffer for more than about a second. It wasn't that he wanted to make sure he died. It was he wanted to make sure he didn't suffer. I thought that was the point they were trying to make. I don't know. Make them out to be cowardly. Yeah.
Well, we'll talk about this at the end, no doubt. But or did he? Because there are lots of theories out there which we'll need to touch on. Okay, so going on with the cast then. I think they were also strong, but we've got to mention there are loads of cast. I've got to mention the main ones. Trowell herself, her real name was Gertrude Trowell Younger, played by Alexandra Maria Lara, who was is a Romanian-German actress. She's a brilliant age match. Trowell was 25 in 1945, and Alexandra Maria Lara was 25 in 2003, which is when they were filming it. I think she was prettier than Trowell, but yeah, that's life.
That's films for you.
Yeah. I think she did really well. She had quite a difficult job to do. And she read this same book all the way through the filming, tried to be as close as possible.
Is that Frau Junger you're talking about?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Frau Junger.
Yeah, she had something in her eyes, like she felt a bit sorry for Hitler, I think, as well. Point I did just want to make was that they didn't mention the Holocaust at all. And I only to say that when I was watching the film, obviously, it's not that I'd forgotten about the Holocaust, but then I got to the end of the film and I thought, I'll have to remember here, as soon as we have any sympathy for him, we have to think about what was happening at this precise moment that wasn't mentioned in the film at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I picked up that the reason why they didn't touch on the Holocaust was because they thought they couldn't do justice to it. You know, people would have said, oh, you know, you just brush that aside sort of thing. So they thought they would just take that as read, that people would know pretty much about that.
Also, there's been so many other movies that have touched on it, and Schindler's List being the probably big one. And then you have the one with Roberto Benigni in it. Loads of films that have touched on the Holocaust.
And there's another thing. I think, again, from just what I picked up, I don't think that they'd have talked very much about it, you know.
They had other things on their minds, didn't they, at the time, to be honest.
They did, yes. You know. And I think it's something that was sort of shoved to the side, you know. I don't think it's something that was talked about very much. I get that impression. Some people even question whether Hitler ordered it or whatever, whether he knew about it, which I think is absurd, because there are so many quotations in speeches and the like where he calls for the destruction of the Jewish people. So, you know, but so the fact that they perhaps didn't talk about it very much makes sense.
I wonder if there was just a little bit of artistic license there, because obviously they had a thing where they were trying to humanize him.
Sure.
Maybe if they'd mentioned it too much, it would have spoiled the kind of characterization they were going for. Is that horribly cynical?
Well, maybe, but if you connect that to the thought that they would then have had to dwell on it in order to do it justice.
Right, you can't just mention it. Yeah, no,
They would have been criticised if they'd mentioned it or not, and I think it's better that they didn't, because like Julian's saying, you just mentioned it in passing, and then, oh, that's more offensive than just actually Taking it as read that it was happening at the time.
And
he does a few times in the film have a go at the Jews, doesn't he, you know? And Bruno Ganz himself said in an interview that he had to cope with that and just sort of grit his teeth and do it. He didn't feel comfortable, of course. He wanted to do the part. It was a big challenge, but he struggled with it. You can imagine, can't you? You know, you're going to be remembered as Hitler. But he was a really nice, really sensitive and intelligent actor. As they all were, really, from what I could see.
I wanted to mention the Goebbels guy, because I'm wondering...
Yes, before you do that, though, just... One thing I wanted to say about Traudl Junge, portrayed by Alexandra Maria Lara, she wanted to get across the idea that there was a sense of shame, but also that she was very naive at the time, you know? She was just carried away with the idea of working for the Führer. She wasn't kind of a dyed-in-the-wool Nazi or anything. And as the film went on, I think... the extent of the horrors that were going on dawned on her. You know, she felt sick at times, didn't she? And she just wished she wasn't there. And her family had said to her, you don't want to be doing that. And she regretted it. So there was a sense of that regret that's there at the beginning of the film when you have an interview with the real Traudl Junge, and at the end of the film.
At the end.
Yeah. So I think she was trying to put that into it. And I think she pulled it off really well. Yeah, go on. So Ulrich Mattes, the guy who plays Josef Goebbels.
Yeah, I'm wondering, I was thinking, if I saw him in lots of other things, I was joking to you earlier, maybe he's got a career in comedies or something, and that this is completely atypical. You never know, do you? Because I've never seen him in anything else, but there was just something very, very strange and creepy about him.
Yeah.
I don't know how much he was made up, because he had a strange face, didn't he?
Yes, yes. Like a wax face almost, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, that's right. His hair was gelled.
His eyes were black, like he had no there's no light in his eyes at all. Really,
that would be perfect, yeah.
Yes, he was perfect. And in fact, a lot of these actors actually look very much like the original people. They interviewed 150 kids for the six Goebbels children to try and get them as close to how those children looked.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's true that Ulrich Mattes does actually look fairly much like Joseph Goebbels. I love the yellow jacket and the yellow tie.
Yeah.
It's so spooky.
Yeah. I mean, can I say, it's been said before, they did have good uniforms, didn't they?
Except for the yellow ones, but yes.
Sure. Yeah, that was a bit rude.
Yeah.
Well, they were designed by Hugo Boss. So
exactly.
Yes.
Now needs to be cancelled, of course.
Yes. Isn't that interesting?
Oh, yes. Yeah, so let's just say that Josef Goebbels, everybody knows him as the, you know, the propaganda minister, but he was actually the Reich Minister for Public Enlightenment and Propaganda. District leader of Berlin. And he was also the Reich plenipotentiary for the total war effort and Führer for one day.
Yes, that's right.
I didn't know that. And he was just Führer for one day when Adolf died. He then took over automatically for one day until, of course, he and his wife took their lives.
One thing we should say is that propaganda in those days wasn't seen negatively. Maybe in the 50s it got like that, and that's why they changed it to public relations. Bernays, you know, we know Bernays and all that.
Yeah. Well, he wrote a book called Propaganda, didn't he, Bernays?
Yeah, I mean, meaning to do a podcast about that for years, but maybe we can in the future.
No, but you're right there, because to actually give him the title Reich Minister for Public Enlightenment and Propaganda must have meant that to the German people that was a perfectly acceptable word at the time.
Well, I always find it more honest that Profumo was the Minister for War, wasn't he? Which doesn't exist. They call it defence minister, right? Wouldn't it?
Yes.
It's the same thing, isn't it? I'm pretty sure. So a bit more honest about that.
His wife, Magda Goebbels, played by Corinna Harfouch, she reckoned that that was the most challenging of the female roles. I'm not sure about that. I actually think Eva Braun was the more challenging role. We'll come to that in a minute. Anyway, I thought Corinna Harfouch did a really good job. Pretty difficult to have to be so cold-hearted with her own kids. She liked the challenge of doing that part, although she didn't like the part. Makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What a peculiar character Magda Goebbels was.
Well, she got the cold-heartedness, but then she was pleading with Hitler. That was quite an affecting scene.
Yes, she was.
Because it made you realise all these people, they are human beings. Yeah. You feel like it or not, they all have, they all cry and laugh. It's just what they laugh and cry at. You know, it's how they react and how misguided they are.
Yeah. Yeah, it's obviously that's something that she really struggled with, trying to understand the character. In the interview, she said that what fascinated her was the idea that somebody could become so possessed by this fanatical ideology that it could twist motherhood, sort of deactivate the very instinct of motherhood. Mm. It's like Magda was somebody who was so inadequate in herself. She needed a strong leader to live for, you know? And once that leader died, then she had nothing and her children had nothing. She, you know, she was just this sort of void. So that's how she tried to make sense of it.
It's so strange, isn't it? Because if you imagine in a horror film, an evil character who decides to kill some children, you'd characterize them as evil. But it seems clear to me that in her head, she's doing what's right for her children.
Yes.
I mean, that's the thing. You could call her evil because she's buying into an evil ideology. But it's strange, isn't it? Mm. The line she had is, "I won't let the children grow up in a world without National Socialism."
Yes.
Isn't it amazing?
It is. Yeah, indeed. It's one of the lessons that I personally draw from this film, which we'll probably talk about in a bit. All right, so Ava Brown, I think she had the most difficult part to do because it was such a peculiar character, wasn't it? So devoted to Hitler, just living in an unreal state of unreality and wanting to party all the time. Frank, have you encountered people like that?
Usually not all the time, no, but like she just was always wanting to party, wasn't she? She just, it was weird. Like I didn't expect Hitler's wife or mistress, I guess, until the last.
Mm. Even when the bombs were dropping, it was just like, oh, there's a bomb, but hey, let's have some wine and dance on a table.
I kind of saw that like one of those times where, like, you know, our goose is cooked anyways, let's go out with a bang kind of thing, you know. Parallel would have been like in the Book of Daniel when the Babylonian guys are, you know, having that party, and then that night the Medes and Persians take over. And they're like, oh, well, let's just go out with a bang, you know.
Yeah, that's what I would do somehow. If I actually knew I was going to die, I'd want to spend the last half an hour doing something enjoyable.
Not finishing it with your tax returns or something.
Oh, dear. I suppose what's so strange about her is that she also had that weird obsession with Hitler at the same time. Totally self-abandoned, wasn't she, to him, which was spooky. And yet at the same time, it would be, oh, let's just go party.
What's the age difference in real life? Was she 18? Or?
She was 17, apparently, when they got together, and he was 40.
Okay.
And she was a photographer working for Hitler's main photographer. So she was 33 when she died, and he was 56.
Okay.
This is assuming they died.
Yes.
We'll come to that in a minute, which I personally believe was the case, but yes.
Yeah, very strange. I just didn't feel like I knew her at all, but I guess maybe that's realistic.
Yeah, well, yeah, according to the book, yes. But what a good job Juliana Kühler did in pulling that off.
Mm.
Such a weird character. Mm. And you saw quite a lot of close shots of her having to smile and respond. And I thought, yeah, gosh, you really did that extremely well. All right, loads of stuff about the production itself. The bunker, I believe, was faithfully recreated. As Mark, you said, an awful lot of it took place in the bunker. They tried not to create lots of sets because they had to for that. They used St. Petersburg in Russia because there were buildings and streets there that matched wartime Berlin. So they filmed in Berlin and in St. Petersburg. Mm-hmm. But the bunker...
The bunker's a set, right?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
It's
especially
built, yeah.
Yeah. And really cramped. They didn't have... Is it called a fourth wall?
Right.
Where they have a sort of like a fake wall where the audience would be or the camera would be. They didn't have that. So it would all feel really cramped inside wherever they were filming. And they also handheld the camera too most of the time.
Oh.
And that was to give the idea of it feeling like a documentary, which I think it did a bit.
Yeah.
It definitely felt like that you were there and these people were real people talking.
Yeah.
It didn't feel they were performing in any sense, did it?
No. And if you watch it carefully, you can just see it. You know, if you just sort of find a little dot on the ceiling or something, you can see the camera slightly moving. So it is right, they did do that.
There's a difference between like, oh, I've got no tripod, I'm going to wave the camera around like a maniac. and just a slight sense that somebody's holding the camera as steadily as they can, but there's a human controlling the camera. They're two different things, aren't they? Some films I can't watch if they're just all over the place. They are.
Yes. No, there was nothing like that.
No.
The first time I saw it, it didn't even cross my mind to ask the question. So it was still enough for that.
Right.
But subconsciously, you know, you're obviously picking up this, oh, this feels a bit real. it was a good idea.
Mm.
And they used things like the light bulbs from the era and stuff to try and get the lighting as close as possible.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. No, the script was pretty good, wasn't it? As far as one can tell, because it's all translated, isn't it? You know, I only have schoolboy German.
There was a bit of info dumping, wasn't there? I mean...
Was there a bit?
Okay. I can't remember where it was at the beginning. Somebody says, as you know, so-and-so...
Was there?
There's a little bit, not much, but a little bit.
Mm.
But you kind of, I suppose, have to, for the benefit of the audience. It's just a slight touch of telling people what they already know.
Well, it's pretty subtle because I didn't pick up on it. That's Bernd Eichinger. So this is the producer who also wrote the script. I think he did a pretty good job. But yeah, obviously not perfect.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, if it had been perfect, he would have been mystified as to what was going on. I think there has to be a little bit of contrivance, I think, isn't there? Mm. I suppose I was being hypercritical. I would note that. Occasionally.
Well, we expect you, Mark, to be hypercritical, if any of us will be.
Yes. And also the subtitles, not that that's anything to do with the film producers.
In what sense?
Well, there was a bit where somebody said Roger, as in over and out Roger.
Yeah.
That stood out. And lots of okay, all right, okay, which, I don't know, didn't quite work for me. And then there was a bit where the children were singing. Mm. And you didn't get that subtitled.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
That would have been interested to see hear what the lyrics were for that.
Yeah, I picked up what that was, actually, somewhere. I'll come to that. I'll mention that scene later, so we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
Okay. Can I say one thing? When I saw six children singing in wartime, were you thinking what I was thinking? What came to mind there, Julian?
You've lost me. Sorry.
Sound off.
Six
sound
children.
Oh!
Yeah, six children singing together. Okay. Well, I don't mean that jokingly.
Anthony, the reason why it didn't come to mind is because there were seven in The Sound of Music.
So anyway. Oh.
We're going to do a movie review of that.
We are, yeah. I'd like to do that. Yeah.
Definitely.
Hooray.
Hmm?
Hooray.
Was that subtitled? Hooray.
Yes.
Talking about the music, it was sort of typical war film music, wasn't it? Not an awful lot of it, minor key, lots of strings and that sort of thing, but they did use Dido's Lament from Henry Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. It's a famous grand bass, and that was used really effectively when Eva was making up at the mirror just before she was going to go off and be done in or do herself in.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the aria, When I Am Laid in Earth. So I thought that was quite fitting that they had that, quite spooky. But apart from that, the film music was pretty standard stuff, but it's okay, worked.
Didn't really notice it.
I was just going to say I didn't notice it either, but now I think of it, I can kind of remember themes, but they didn't do like any dramatic music when they were committing suicide, because they made it look incredibly mundane on one level.
Well, it's all in her performance, isn't it? I mean, that scene is just about the performance and the heartbreak, and she's still doing it. Horrible. You just have the sound of the breaking capsule, you know, that's all you need.
Yeah, there's something really disturbing about that.
Yeah.
They were killing the dog as well, just that horrible sound.
Yes.
I know.
Yes.
That's why I was sort of addressed the telly and said, why don't you just let them go? Because they'll be looked after. Why are you killing them, you know?
Mm.
I still find that hard to believe, that they would have just said, let the children go at least, and then everyone else would have killed themselves. I thought that was... I mean, that was really evil, wasn't it? I mean, that's inhuman, you know.
Yes, she was dehumanized somehow by this ideology, wasn't she?
Mm.
Yeah, I don't think this is... I mean, there's always somebody who doubts everything, but I think, generally speaking, this is not... There isn't a question mark over this. I think the bodies of the kids were found.
Mm.
I hear that Josef Goebbels himself objected to the idea initially, but then came round to it. And one of the interviewees said, I think it might have been the historian, he justified it in terms of creating a myth that the Reich was somehow continuing in a quasi-spiritual sense if the kids were gone. I mean, you know, sick. Was it you, Anthony, said earlier that she had said something like she didn't want the kids to exist without the Führer and without the Reich?
Yeah.
It all had to come.
I won't let the children grow up in a world without National Socialism.
That's it.
That might be a direct quote, I don't know if it was, maybe it wasn't, but that was the point. But it's quite ironic as well that they've got six children together, isn't it? Because they seem, their relationship just seems so clinical and almost polite in a weird way. You're getting kind of a politeness between them, wasn't it? It's strange.
Yes, it was. They were very proud of the children, but I noticed how the scenes that we saw, they were proud of the children, particularly insofar as they pleased Hitler. There was one scene, particularly later on, where the children were singing for the people in the bunker. It was like a little concert.
Yeah,
and
that's
there,
what made
there
me.
Was a professor of medicine was coming through to speak to Hitler. And as he was going through, you saw these kids. And Magda was conducting the children, very, very proud of them that they were doing this. And it's something so, I don't know, twisted about the whole thing.
Creepy.
Not valuing them for who they were in themselves, but kind of insofar as they pleased the Führer, you know, weird.
Very strange, yeah.
So I can find that song. So the kids in the first scene they were singing, this is when they went to sing for Uncle Hitler, and they sang Kein schöner Land in dieser Zeit, so that's no country more beautiful in this time. And Joseph was conducting them in pride. One of the kids was sitting on Hitler's knee or something. That's the scene.
When I first saw the children in the bunker, I'm like, what in the world? Like, I didn't know that there had been children in there in history. It makes sense, but I was just, that took me aback quite a bit. I'm like, wow, there's like the world falling apart around them. They have children in there singing concerts to them. It was really a weird thing for me.
It was. And you do think, don't you, why, as you said, Mark, you know, why couldn't they just, because I mean, the children would have been fine.
Yeah.
And then they'd have said the mother has to stay with the children, so she probably have not been executed. Okay, Joseph would have been.
Yeah.
But, you know.
But that's a good question, though. But do you really, like, because the Soviets were the ones who came to Berlin, weren't they?
Yes, that's right.
I would wonder if the Soviets would really let Goebbels' wife go. I mean, she could lie and say she's someone else, and the children could too, but...
I suppose it would depend on who actually encountered them first.
Yeah. I think she probably would have been, she might have been taken away from them, but they would have, might. I think, been kept. They would have survived in care.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I just would wonder how, if they had lived, if children had lived, I mean, what would the Soviets have done with them? Because Stalin was a really bad guy too, you know? And that would be like a good PR victory for him. It's like, look, we have Goebbels' children here. Mm-hmm. You
know? Well, yes. Re-indoctrinate them as good Soviet citizens, perhaps, and parade them as...
That would be something I could do, for sure.
Yeah. Well, there are quite horrendous stories of what the Soviet soldiers apparently did, wasn't there, when they came in.
Yeah. The whole situation, from whatever angle you look at it, was just totally bleak, wasn't it, with all kinds of atrocities going on. It was very clear. It was just total barren moral landscape. That's why it's so difficult to watch, but I think necessary to watch. And the director hopes it would, you know, serve as a document, you know, historical document, which I think it does.
I mean, it could have been far worse, what they chose to show us. I mean, it, you know, it was...
It's
hard watching, but if you want to show all the atrocities, it could have been, you know, much worse.
Yes, yes. And we mustn't say, you know, this was special to this time. The atrocities go on in all kinds of war situations. And, this is representative, isn't it? Symbolic of lots of situations.
Well, I mean, it's hard to... I'm not condoning what anyone did, but... I can't imagine what it must be like to be in war and to be shot at from all sides and lose my essentially humanity, and then you're faced with the enemy that you've shot your friends. And I don't know whether these people are out of their minds, I would have thought, in the field, out in there, bloodlust or whatever. I think unless you've gone anywhere near that sort of thing, it's really hard to judge, if you like. You're exhibiting behaviour perhaps you've never, ever done before or ever would again.
Yes.
But I think it's a collective madness that takes hold, I don't know.
I agree.
Frank, were there any scenes that particularly jumped out at you? I know we talked about some already, so that's not quite fair. We might already have talked about the most significant one for you, but is there anything else that comes to mind?
Probably the most significant one was when they were mixing the drink for the children, and then they killed them in their sleep with the cyanide. That was very chilling to me. We've already kind of talked about that one.
But we haven't talked to... You're right, though. There's that very clinical scene first where Magda is there with that doctor chap, and they're actually mixing the... Because they were first of all given something to put them to sleep, weren't they? It was supposed to be a health drink.
They were telling the children it was, like, good for them, you know, and, like... And then one of them didn't believe it, and then they had to force her to drink it.
Oh, the oldest. So,
that was traumatic.
Yeah, absolutely. It was... It was.
Now, I picked up something that might be in this book. Not the exact detail of that, but some sense that the oldest one was... less trusting of what was going on. So there was some truth to that. It's horrendous.
I think in general the way children were portrayed in this movie is what jumped out at me the most, actually, because there were a couple other scenes where there was children fighting. One of the kids, he couldn't have been any older than 12. He had destroyed a tank with a Panzerfaust, I believe.
That's right.
And then the girl was fighting, and she like made somebody shoot her to die when the Russians were coming. And then there was one scene where Hitler was giving the children awards outside the bunker.
That's right.
I thought that was a really interesting scene. I'm like, wow, his army had been reduced to children at that point.
It was Peter, wasn't it? Peter was the character.
It was just interesting to see that they even acknowledged there was children around that time, and then they showed what they were doing. I don't think a lot of war movies have really done that.
Mm. Yeah, there was a collection of children, wasn't there?
Yeah.
They were like part of this Berlin Defense Force that was thrown together from whoever happened to be around, really. It was also chaotic.
Right, yeah.
And these kids were totally devoted, well, some of them anyway, were totally devoted to the Führer.
Yeah.
Others were just sort of keeping their mouths shut. But, I mean, and some of this was device, wasn't it? Like, mm-hmm. You know, the father of the child came along and was a sort of voice of reason with them.
Right.
Whether he's a real character, he represented people who were in their right minds. Anyway, and he was saying, look, what are you here for? The Russians are coming. Soon as they come down the street, you're gone.
Yeah.
Your loyalty to the Führer means nothing.
Peter called his
and yet this, sorry?
Peter called his dad a coward.
Peter's dad, was it?
Yeah, it was Peter's dad. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Mm. Do you think, I don't know whether that child was a real character in history or whether, again, a device for representing children who were in that situation.
Was he in the book?
I didn't pick that up. No, because she was in the bunker, wasn't she? She didn't really experience.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Because
yeah,
this is one of the big things of the film, wasn't it? The contrast and the juxtaposition of the weird stuff going on in the bunker. Hitler talking about imaginary armies. And then you would cut to the people being blown apart in the streets. And it was just, like, you know, surreal, divorced from reality.
Yeah.
He was playing war games, wasn't he? He was moving his clawed hand across a map in the map room with all his generals standing there. And another thing about that was he actually did get his generals to stand and turn the ventilation off. So the actors actually had to do that, to stand for absolutely ages. I suppose that was a technique to keep them uncomfortable. I don't know.
In these tiny little rooms, yeah.
Weird. Yeah. He was a weird guy.
I want to ask you guys about all the stuff Hitler was saying about the German people, that they deserved it.
Yes.
Is that a Darwinian thing where he's saying they're just not strong enough or something?
Yes.
Again, it's just him rationalising in his mind. I think that's what it comes down to, isn't it?
Yes.
Did he say something like, well, they voted for me, so this is what they're getting, kind of thing?
Something like that. He said, they failed the test and I won't shed a tear for them, or something like that.
Mm. Something
very strange, isn't it?
It is.
Yes. He certainly had this sense that everybody let him down, that you know, he hadn't put a foot wrong.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah,
that's classic psychopathy, I think.
Oh, you talked about the death of the children, that's terrible, obviously. Mm. And this isn't in the same league, but it's still, when he kills his dog, does he kill his dog or...
Yes.
Yes.
That bit.
Well, again, did he? Because I think so. But then in the movie Grey Wolf, apparently Blondie is there, being taken off to Argentina. Although it wasn't named, there is a dog, and then there's a scene where there are two tiny gravestones, one with Blondie on, and one with Blondie 2. So,
that was Blondie 3 in the video.
Calling the dog Blondie, I mean, presumably that's real, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Blondie, as in Aryan.
Yes.
I mean, that was, I can't remember if that came before the children or after, but you kind of thought, okay, this is where we're at. Yes.
It was before, wasn't it? Because I think the children were murdered after Hitler and Eva are gone.
I suppose the thing about the dog was that this was almost like, this is who Hitler loved the most. This dog was very close to him.
Yes.
Did he himself killed his dog?
Not sure.
Or did somebody else?
I think someone was doing it right in front of him.
Right, doing it in front of him, but he was watching the death of this person he loved the most. Yes. And I thought, this is crazy, really, isn't it?
Yes.
I did commit the sin of listening to another podcast, trying not to get too many ideas, but they were wondering whether he was testing it on the dog.
Yes, I'd heard that too.
Was that the point, or was it because he just thought the dog couldn't survive without him or something? I don't know. Both.
Maybe both. Yeah. Got to get rid of it, so let's test it.
Mm.
But you're right, he was devoted to it, because one of the very first scenes, the secretaries, the hopefuls, have to stand there because the Führer is feeding his dog. Mm. They have to stand and wait for him to finish feeding his dog.
Mm. It seems to be a bit of a theme, because I think a lot of serial killers seem to like animals.
Yeah.
I think because they're just pure, and they generally have a war against people, don't they? You know, in their mind.
Yeah. I suppose the dog is an obedient slave, will never answer back.
Yeah.
Wasn't one of his assistants, like one of the women, I forget who it was, but she was sort of like the one taking care of Blondie, and then she said once in a while she'll like kick him or like mistreat him.
Eva said she was jealous of the dog because Hitler.
Right. Yeah.
That's right, it was Eva.
And then would wonder why the dog was acting weird, you know?
Oh, poor dog. I feel sorry for the dog now. Oh, dear.
Yeah,
go back to this thing of Hitler, you know, not believing that he ever made a mistake. It was always his generals that made them, so people let him down. There was a good scene about that with a General Helmut Wilding, who was holding troops against the Russians, doing the best job he could, and he was basically failing, but, you know, he was holding. And Hitler accused him of actually pulling back and sent a telephone message off to say, you've got to be shot now because you've betrayed me. And so this general then had to make his way into the bunker to be shot.
Yeah.
But then gave a report and Hitler believed it. And then he made him commander of Berlin or whatever. But it was such a weird thing that, you know, there was no listening to reason. It was like, oh, it's not going the way I think. So it must be your fault. It's not my mistake.
Paranoia, isn't it? It's sheer paranoia. I mean, being in the bunker is a sort of physical representation of paranoia.
Mm.
Trust anyone around him, apart from the dog.
Yeah. But there were bits, though, Julian, wasn't there? There was two occasions, I think, where he didn't kill someone that he could have done. Someone came to him and deliberately said they countermanded his order, and it was almost as if he admired their honesty somehow.
Yes.
I remember that.
Albert Speer, he had a huge regard for Speer. There was a good scene, wasn't there, where the architecture for the new city, you know, the model was there, wasn't it? And it was just Hitler and Speer talking in this room. And it was like there was this mutual respect, particularly Hitler respecting this man as the artist, you know, with the vision, reflecting the artistry and vision of Hitler himself, although he wasn't as talented. And I think Speer, was it Speer who had gone against his orders, but he lets him off? There were other people as well, I agree. It wasn't just him.
Speer, yeah. I've just got in my notes. He admits to Hitler he defied his orders to destroy Germany's infrastructure. Hitler, however, does not punish him.
Yeah.
And he decides to leave Berlin.
Well, he was an artist himself, wasn't he, Hitler?
I don't want to upset any listeners you might have from Liverpool, Julian, but Hitler lived in Liverpool for a while. Did you know that?
Yes, I did. I did know that.
Don't have the address, though. I don't want to know.
Exactly, yes.
I won't be going there as a pilgrimage.
They're talking about the megalomania of Hitler. That didn't come over too much to Traudl Junger, because, you know, he was very fond of her and all that. But, you know, she did overhear him speak sometimes in those terms, and it was a shock to her, but she did encounter it. Mm. So this is Hitler speaking, and she heard this. She asks, "My Führer, why haven't you married, Eva?" And he says, "I wouldn't make a good father, and I think it would be irresponsible to start a family when I can't devote enough time to my wife. And anyway, I don't want children of my own. I think the offspring of men of genius usually have a very hard time of it. People expect them to be just like their famous progenitor and won't forgive them for being only average. And in fact, most of them are feeble-minded." You know, And he also said, another one here is, he used to say, "I am an instrument of fate, and I must tread the path on which a higher providence has set me."
Yeah. Well, Goebbels, in his sort of his final address before he dies, talked about the truth will finally come out or something, wasn't it?
Yes.
It'll be the moment when we stand above everything pure and unblemished.
That's it. Extraordinary.
Pure and unblemished.
Well, it comes back to this notion that he thought he was doing the right thing in his twisted way.
Yeah.
Because he was so taken over by the ideology. Within that, he thought he was doing the right thing, even though what he was doing was evil.
Mm. Well, most evil people don't think they're evil, do they?
Mm.
Whether it's serial killers or whatever, they think they're doing the right thing. They're cleansing the world of whoever. It's the right thing to do.
Yes.
Yeah, well, definitely.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that I do take from this. You know, if people become so wedded to an ideology that is fanatical and is controlling, then people can think they're doing the right thing, when in fact they're doing something that can be really detrimental for other people. But it doesn't matter, because they're doing the right thing. And you see this extreme example of it in somebody like Joseph Goebbels.
Mm.
But, you know, I worry about, I don't mean a Nazi ideology, but a fanatical, rigid, controlling ideology. And how far could that go in some cases?
Well, checks and balances is the key thing there, isn't it? I mean, as long as there are people with different ideas constantly arguing against other people, and that means for stagnation, perhaps.
It's absolutely essential, isn't it? And that's one of the things we did not have, for example, during the so-called pandemic.
Mm.
Anybody who argued against the narrative was shouted down.
Mm-hmm.
And that was extremely unhealthy and extremely dangerous. And I'm thinking particularly of the, you know, the vaccinate everybody policy, which was irrational.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think a lot of people who got on board with that thought this was the right thing to do, sort of bought into it. But it was, in its own way, an ideology. Because not everybody needed it. And, you know, arguably nobody needed it, but that is an arguable point. I don't think it's arguable to say that not everybody needed it, and perhaps very few people even arguably needed it. But it was, you know, you've got to vaccinate the whole world. And
yeah.
you know, doesn't matter how much it costs, doesn't matter if we lock people in their homes until it happens, or do you know what I mean? It's yeah, it was the right thing to do. And it reminds me, of course, of the vaccine minister with vaccine passports voting for that and recommending them, and at the same time saying, it goes against everything I believe in, but it's the right thing to do. Which is extraordinary when I heard that. But
I just had a coworker told me to do my part and that I should get vaccinated when they first came out. I'm like, why? I had it already, you know?
There you go. Yeah, I don't want to just concentrate on that. It was just one little example, but yeah, I'm sure we could come up with other examples. How things can just get twisted, you know?
It's like the one-size-fits-all theory. The simpler it is, somehow the more appealing it is. Mm. If you don't have any clauses or anything, it's just, that's it, one sentence, one line, that's the solution, you know, the ultimate solution, whatever. Then, okay, we're drawn to this now, it's attractive.
Mm. And that was a huge feature of the Nazi ideology, wasn't it? Because it was all very simple, non-analyzable terms like nation and people and blood and Aryan and Reich and fate and providence, with no God, of course, in the picture. You know, what are these things, or history, the force of history, what do these things even mean? But they were kind of symbols, almost like the swastika itself, you know. Simple, you could just follow it.
I think that's what politics is. Political debates have become like that, haven't they?
You know?
I always joke that in America they say, right, he's going to talk about the economy, you've got 90 seconds, you know. Can you just boil it down?
Yeah.
Just use a few buzzwords. I think it's buzzwords as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
The kind of words that have a certain energy.
Yeah.
Probably guilting people into it as well, I imagine, as well. Mm. All that stuff Hitler says about how history will remember you well. You know, if you don't leave Berlin, you just stay to a certain day. History will remember you well.
Yes. And that's history with a capital H, isn't it? Something weirdly sort of transcendent in his mind, which of course isn't, but I suppose he had a lot of German idealism in his background.
What did he say, that thing about compassion wasn't in human nature? That was another line, wasn't it?
Was it?
Yeah, he said compassion's not part of human nature.
It's like when Tony Blair, when Princess Diana died and Tony Blair was interviewed and said, I don't believe in sound bites. But she was the people's princess.
And Alistair Campbell wrote that for him, didn't he? In that film with Helen Mirren, he says, people's princess, you owe me one, Tony. Yeah.
There's another thing I got from this was, strangely enough, was just Joseph Goebbels himself being Führer for one day. Mm. I know the whole Nazi system was falling apart because of the war situation. But had it not been that, let's just suppose that Hitler had a heart attack and died. Goebbels would have taken over and he would have been the Führer. And I noticed he was barking orders in the same sort of way that Hitler was. Mm. And I thought, oh, yeah, there were assassination attempts on Hitler. Would it have made any difference? Mm. I'm not sure that it would. You know, somebody else, well, Joseph would have stepped into the same shoes and the system would have just carried on.
Yeah.
It wasn't all about Hitler, was it? It was this system that had been created by him and those people who had followed him, and then there was kind of back loops, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Hitler was sort of then buoyed up by the following that he had, and then this machine would have carried on, I think. And that reminds me that, you know, the idea of finding the whatever the problem is, you know, like, I don't know, you want to get rid of Klaus Schwab because he's this sort of figurehead for the World Economic Forum. Is it, if we got rid of him, everything would be fine. But no, it would just be somebody else who steps in there. And it's the, you know, it's resisting the whole system that matters rather than individuals, you know.
Yeah, that's a perfect example because, you know, everyone's talked about how George Soros is like the Darth Sidious behind everything, you know. And like, yeah, okay, let's say you arrest him, go to jail, or he cacks, you know. He has a son, yeah. Alexander, who will just step right into his shoes, you know.
Mm-hmm. And same with Anthony Fauci, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, he should face justice.
But there's a whole system behind
him,
too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's some other guy, isn't there, who's being suggested as taking over the job. I can't remember the name, but arguably just as unpleasant.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a bit like the Hydra, isn't it? You keep cutting heads off, but there's all more heads there.
Well, that's an interesting analogy because, in a way, that's sort of what a lot of the Nazi ideology did. You know, we had a lot of Nazis come here to America under Project Paperclip for the rocket programs. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I bring it up as a parallel because in the Marvel movies, you had this offshoot of the Nazism called Hydra. And then later on, you find out that the Hydra organization had actually infiltrated just about every level of everything, including the superhero spy agency, you know. Mm. And so, like, you didn't really need Hitler. You already had the other heads of the Hydra in place that were kind of autonomous.
Yeah, and what it tells me is, you know, if you look at a system that seems moving in a very authoritarian, even totalitarian direction, such as, for example, the cashless society and all the problems, that the challenges that could present to us. It's not about identifying individuals and calling for them to be tried and put in jail or whatever, is it? It's about all of us seeing potential difficulties like that and resisting that and not taking part in that. You know, if enough people don't go along with whatever system is developing, then it can't happen. But it takes enough people to think in that way. You know what I mean? So in my own little way, I'm using cash as much as I can because I think it's very dangerous for us to lose that.
I work in a shop that's cashless, so interesting to hear that.
Right, well, it's a whole another subject, isn't it? But yeah, the idea of being completely cashless so that a cashless society can have, you know, digital currency, which can be programmable. And so therefore you're in a social credit situation where if you don't do the right thing, then you can be punished by not being able to make certain purchases or being nudged into purchasing in a certain way by people in power. And, you know, you could say, oh, well, that couldn't go wrong, could it? You know, because we live in democracies. But we've just been through 3 years where we've seen authoritarian trends, which are quite disturbing. Do we really want to create an infrastructure where that could go seriously, dangerously wrong? And if we look at the lessons of the 20th century, I think the answer is no, we do not. Mm-hmm. And it's pointless pointing at particular individuals and saying, oh, well, they shouldn't be in charge of the WEF, or they shouldn't be doing this because they speak in such terms. We should be saying, look, let's do everything we can on an individual level to make sure that system itself doesn't get set in stone such that it can be manipulated, you know? Right. I get that kind of lesson from it. But can we talk about this very controversial business about, do they actually, Hitler and Eva, die in that situation? Mm. For me, this is a bit like the moon landings in that I'm sort of split on it. You know, a lot of historians will say, oh, it's unthinkable, it's ridiculous and whatnot. But actually, I'm not sure it is ridiculous. I think it's possible. I think I don't actually believe these theories. But Anthony, you mentioned a particularly good interview with Gerard Williams. Tell us about that, because I listened to it.
So there's a journalist called Gerard Williams, and he was on The Unexplained with Howard Hughes, if you know that one. Howard Hughes was on Talk Radio, I think, wasn't he? Used to have a kind of conspiracies or anything, mysteries, that kind of thing. And this Gerard Williams came on there, and I think really the salient point, I don't know which of the facts were true. He seems very convinced, but his real point, aside from the evidence he's got, that, you know, someone pointed out Hitler's house, and he even gave a date for his death. It was something specific, like 4th of February 1962. It was incredible.
I've got it written down. It was the 13th of February 1962, apparently according to a Dr. Otto Lehmann, who testified to having dealt with Hitler in his last days.
Very strange.
It is very strange, isn't it? Yes.
But there definitely is a German connection to that part of the world. I know that. Yes. I did know that because I know a little bit about South America. But Gerard Williams, I mean, the point he made was, the point that Howard Hughes made was, Gerard Williams is not just a, you know, conspiracy theorist on the internet. He spent years, he spent lots of his own money traveling, and he's risking his reputation. Why would he do that and then produce a book that's all baseless? But I'd go with what you said, Julie. I mean, maybe, who knows? Maybe people are giving him information, feeding him exaggerated information. I don't know.
Well, this is it. I saw the movie because it's recently been put on for free on YouTube, you know, legitimately. Yes. For free on YouTube by the distribution company.
You watched it on my behalf, Stephen.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And I liked it. I enjoyed it. It was entertaining. I thought it was a bit weak. It was weaker than the interview, because in the interview he gave much more a sense that he himself, as a journalist, had spoken to individual people. Right. Whereas in the movie, it was like, well, these were testimonies that were floating in the film, but you didn't know where they came from. So we have his testimony, as it were, that he'd actually spoken to certain people. But one thing that crossed my mind was, you know, let's face it, the Nazis are not known for telling the truth all that much. Mm. And they're also rather keen on inventing myths to big up their ideas. To what extent should I trust these testimonies? Maybe it's possible they wanted the myth of the Führer in Argentina, because maybe it gave the Nazis over there some sense of kudos. I don't know. Mm. Just a question mark that I have about that. Was he being led down the garden path, rather? Don't know.
Well, Gerard Williams did pick up on another point that you mentioned, Frank, about Operation Paperclip. Because I think the public are pretty ignorant about that. I mean, I probably didn't know about it until 7 or 8 years ago. Gerard Williams would make a wider point that not all the top Nazis were hung after Nuremberg, you know?
Right.
Who's the NASA guy? Bernard von Braun. Yeah.
Von Braun, yeah.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about him is I think he worked closely with the Disney company to make movies about this stuff. And then when you look at like what the ideologies Disney's are pushing today, it's like it makes you wonder. I don't know that they that's not the ideology, but it's definitely him pushing weird ideologies now. And when they had those ties all the way back then, you know.
I can't remember thinking anything along Nazi lines when I watched Bambi, I have to say.
Yeah.
It was a while ago. I know what you mean, though, Frank.
Yeah, clearly they're not promoting like actual Nazi ideology, but there's definitely some strange ideologies of their own now. So.
Yes. Yes. Well, I'm being serious. Frank, sorry.
Sorry, yeah, I brought up to Julian. It's called The Rise of the Fourth Reich by Jim Mars. I don't know what I think about the book. There's a lot of interesting bits of documentation, but the first couple of pages deal with the escape of Hitler. I've read it years ago, but he basically posits that Hitler made use of a double in the bunker and that the real Hitler had escaped to some other location. Yeah. I think using a Junker 52 float plane.
Right.
Yeah, I'm just looking here.
While you look, I'll just mention that there's a, I think it's a History Channel production, so make of that what you will, called Hunting Hitler. And in it, although I've not seen it, but I've come across this information, some researchers called Lenny DePaul and Sasha Kyle claim to have found, now what is it, a forensic reconstruction. By forensic reconstruction, they've located a possible escape tunnel from the bunker itself.
Oh.
Of course, if that's true, that lends credence to the view that did escape, because Gerard Williams suggests that they escaped from the chancellery, because apparently there was an escape tunnel there, but of course they were in the bunker, so, well. And then the idea is then maybe they were flown to Denmark by an SS officer who did in fact testify, and I have a testimony here of that. Where is it? Yeah, so this is... so this is from a paper called The Advocate in Tasmania. For some reason, it's reported here. So this is 1949, Wednesday the 9th of February 1949. This person maintains Hitler escaped to Denmark. I just read of London, Tuesday. Captain Peter Baumgart, a former German Luftwaffe pilot who insisted he flew Hitler and Eva Braun to Denmark shortly before the fall of Berlin, was today sentenced by a tribunal of three Polish judges to imprisonment for 5 years for being a member of the SS. So this guy reckons he took them to Denmark. And then Gerard Williams suggests, based on various testimonies, that was then flown to Spain, then to the Canary Islands, and then got on a U-boat off to Argentina.
And spent 54 days underwater.
Right,
yeah. Yeah, incredible.
And then didn't do very much when he when he got there.
Relaxed for 17 years.
Yeah.
The thing is, okay, this is all based on effectively hearsay, isn't it? It's people who've long since died. There's no way of testing any of this. Right.
Sure, you have to trust the testimonies. Yeah.
I was going to say, is that in Hitler's character to do that, to behave in that way at the end? I mean,
I don't think so.
It doesn't seem.
No.
I don't think. I mean, for all it might have happened, but I just think it goes against everything we know about Hitler up until then that he would do that.
I agree with you. I think the psychological arguments against this are pretty strong. A lot of people might think that's weak, but I actually put quite a lot of store by that.
Right.
I mean, I don't think the Goebbels would have killed their children, certainly if they knew Hitler and Eva had escaped. Because that was the whole point, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They can't live in the world without him. Well, if he's still alive, you know, it doesn't make any sense. They'd have had to not know. But I suppose if there was a tunnel from the bunker, well, maybe, but then it would have meant that Günscher, the guy who had to burn the bodies, he would have had to be in on the plot and find alternative bodies, and it's a long stretch, I think.
Hitler doesn't strike me as the kind of person who would stay quiet for long.
No.
So I just think that, again, if he went somewhere, he would pop up, he would be known.
Yes.
It doesn't sit right.
No, and I don't understand. I agree. I don't understand what he would have... Why would he want to have escaped, you know? To do what? To go over to Argentina and...
To go straight.
And what would he have done? I mean, Perón wouldn't have wanted him to raise a Fourth Reich or Fifth Reich or whatever over in Argentina, would he? So what would he have... Sure. It's a whole different geography situation. Mm. What were they going to fight against? What were they going
to
do?
You happen to believe that he basically kind of retired, didn't he?
And yeah.
Decided an easy life was better.
But that doesn't fit with him as the self-sacrificing great hero, you know, and he had plenty of sort of German romanticism person behind him to sort of die as the great self-renouncing Schopenhauer-inspired Wagnerian soul.
Yeah.
Everybody's let me down. The German people have let me down. I'm too good for the world. That fits the psychology as far as I can see. Not just going off to the other side of the world and eating pot noodles the rest of your life. You know?
Play golf.
Play golf, yeah. I know, it's a real question, of course. I don't want to, for a moment, poo-poo anybody for looking into all this and reaching different conclusions. I think it's worth looking at, you know. And I'm far from 100% sure about it myself, as I've said.
Let's do The Boys from Brazil next.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's another good film. Mm. A very different film, but yeah.
I did enjoy Gregory Peck as Dr. Mengele in that one.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, I think if we're going to make any comment about it, I think we should do it now because I don't want to do that one, having done this one.
Right.
It is actually a very good film, I agree. Very far-fetched, but yeah, gripping.
It's a bit of a different kind of
thing. It is. Yeah, sure.
Julian, did you watch the Hitler and Stalin documentary? Did I send that to you or not?
No, you didn't. No, I didn't see that.
Could put it in the show notes, maybe. Now, the salient point, really, was that they had very, very similar upbringings. Yeah, there's a documentary called Hitler and Stalin, Roots of Evil, I think, and made the point that even though they had apparently opposite ideologies, it's the same madness caused by severe deprivation that was in both of them, you know, and the megalomania and everything else. Mm-hmm. Hitler tried to run away and his father beat him so badly he was in a coma for days. Mm. So again, it's not to excuse, obviously, but to say that
things contribute to how people are, for sure. Mm. Yes.
Yeah, and it was interesting that Hitler and Stalin, I mean, they were allies, I suppose, weren't they? Because the 1941 invasion came apparently out of the blue, didn't it? Because they were allies. But you could see them, obviously having so many similarities that they either would have clashed or they would have been almost kindred spirits. I don't know. Yeah. But they chose different ideologies. That's a big point of this, isn't it? The madness and the ego and the megalomania is the same. They just chose different ideologies.
Mm. At the end of the day, I wonder how different they are.
They're more similar than they are different in certain respects, I think.
Mm. Yeah, and it's often said, isn't it, you know, Hitler's the most evil man of the 20th century, and I'm thinking, well, Stalin maybe.
Yeah, numbers-wise,
I wouldn't want to choose between them, but yeah, numbers-wise, maybe Stalin wins.
Numbers-wise, I think Chairman Mao would win.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree. Mm.
By how many times they've been played on screen by actors, I think Hitler would be the most successful.
It was what we were saying earlier, wasn't it? It's charisma in inverted commas. There was something weirdly compelling about him.
Yes.
I mean, I'd love to have met him, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you just
oh, yes.
Just to get 10 minutes in his company and think, okay, I can see, I get it now. I get what people saw in him because it's very hard to see what people could find attractive in him.
Well, that's what we get from Bruno Ganz's portrayal. I think we do see something of that, and it is in the book. He was very polite with people and very pleasant. You know, I don't want to say that, but that apparently is the case and helps to make sense of what happened.
Yeah. Can I ask you, Julian, from the book,
what's
the relationship between Frau Junger and Hitler? Is it? It's obviously, it's not a romantic thing, is it? But was she attracted to him or did she feel sorry for him, do you think? Because I felt like she felt sorry for him a bit in the film.
Maybe. Somebody described Hitler as being like a shell with an exterior of self-pity, but inside pretty murderous. Yeah. But in the book, she's rather in awe of him. I think the actress describes the situation as ladies in general at the time considered Hitler to be a bit of a pop star. So she was in awe of him and saw a lot of mundane pleasantness and civility from him. But then also this other side, where he was never wrong and behaved irrationally. But most of the time, I think she just thought he was a pleasant individual, you know. But she felt very guilty about that afterwards. I mean, one of the things she says at the end of the film is that she could have found out, people in her situation could have found out. They sort of didn't want to look beyond the walls, as it were.
Yeah.
And that's another lesson, I think, for us today, isn't it? People who refuse to look at things that are going on that are wicked because they don't want to find out. And there's an element of, well, you know, there's no excuse. You should look. That's a hard lesson for us all.
That brings up that old famous quote, all it takes for evil to succeed is for good men to do nothing.
Absolutely.
And in the book, they thought they were free. I've said this on the podcast before, with the recollections of people from the Nazi times when that, you know, it was all developing in the 1930s. There was a lot of that. Mm. Just people keeping quiet.
Yeah.
You could see the wrong thing was happening. You know, somebody was being, the Nazi was being appointed to the position, and they could have spoken up, and they chose not to because they didn't want to be ridiculed or thought ill of. And yeah, this is how these things grow. And it's true today. And we've had spades full of it recently. You know, oh, you mustn't say this and you mustn't say that. You'll be called a conspiracy theorist or a nut or a COVID denier or whatever it is. And whatever side of whichever argument you're on, we come back to that truth that we need to have open discussion about everything, don't we? So that the truth can come out.
Mature open discussion. You know, polite open discussion.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Not Twitter.
No, not that sort of social media back and forth.
No.
A mature conversation, exactly what we need.
Yeah.
And it's been really depressing to see that, lots of censorship recently. So, yeah, tons and tons of fantastic lessons from a very difficult film, a wonderful film. Anybody who's not seen it, please do go and see this. But, of course, with the caveat that it's pretty disturbing in places, but you will not be disappointed. It is an historical document. I think that's right. I think Oliver Hirschenberger is right about that. So please do go and see it. And it's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming on. I hope we've done it justice. any last thoughts from any of you?
Just the lesson, really, about, I wanted to say just earlier when you were talking about how Hitler had lost reality. Mm. Basically, we all make up narratives of our lives. And what they were doing was just making up what we would call a twisted narrative. He had a twisted narrative going. I have a meetup group here in my town, and we have kind of philosophical, psychological discussions. And there's an old gentleman, he's about 80, but he's full of vim and vigor, and he likes talking about stuff. His philosophy is that he believes that people are always doing the best they can in the situation they're in. So he would conclude that Hitler was doing the best he could in the situation he was in. And the problem is what was going on in his mind. And as I said earlier, all these Nazis, they all did the same things in terms of eating and sleeping and laughing and dancing, whatever. But it's just with this twisted narrative.
Yes, yes.
So it's the idea of we're all kind of making up narratives.
Yes.
You know, in our own lives.
Absolutely.
Who we are.
Well, that's true.
Things that happen.
And why it's so important then to scrutinize those narratives and have a conversation about what's true and what isn't. And once that's shut down, we're in trouble. That's really dangerous. And all this deep, you know, no platforming, cancelling people. It's really dangerous stuff.
Yeah.
It hasn't got as bad as the film we've just looked at, has it? But
Well, it's getting there. And as you said, Julian, that's why we've got to say something about it before it gets where the film is, you know?
Yeah.
So
that's true. And this is part, hopefully this conversation is just a tiny little part of doing exactly that. So thanks, gentlemen, for coming on, talking about a really difficult film to talk about. It's been good. Difficult but good.
You're welcome. It's been great. Great watching the film and scrutinizing it. It's great watching these films in preparation for podcasts.
Indeed. Though perhaps this is the hardest one to do, though. I think it did get me down.
Yeah.
The first half got me down. I can actually make notes on the second half, but managed to. Because that's it. When you watch the whole thing straight through, it has more of an effect on you because you don't analyze everything, do you? You think about it afterwards.
Mm. I had a commentary going as well. I have this thing where if I'm rewatching a film, sometimes I'll watch it with a commentary on, but with the subtitles. So I'll kill two birds with one stone a little bit. But I watched this one without commentary as well. So it really stood up. Yeah, brilliant.
Good. And the last thing I would say is if you do get a DVD with the interviews on, like most films, you know, you say, oh, I know, who cares what they think, sort of thing. No, listen to those interviews with the actors because they really went to a lot of effort and they're an intelligent and creative bunch. Mm. Really good.
Mm.
Everybody involved, really, as far as I could tell. So thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joel.
Indeed. Great speaking with you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us on.
And how about that, Mark?
Whoa-ho!
7 o'clock. Exactly 7 o'clock. We can't speak to Oscar as a consequence. Never mind.
No, I'm sorry.
Show notes for this programme can be found at The Mind Renewed, themindrenewed.com. Podcast music by the brilliant Anthony Rajakov, attribution non-commercial, share alike 4.0 international. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, and my guests, Frank Johnson, Anthony Rotuno, and Mark Campbell, and I very much look forward to speaking to you again in the near future.